Krishnamurti Law Firm has been clarifying U.S. immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome. This is Sheila Murthy. Thank you so much for joining us for today's discussion on different trends that we are noticing with the CBP or Customs and Border Protection at U.S. ports of entry, whether it's airports, land ports, seaports, but primarily we're talking about airports as points of entry. And today we're not just going to speak about the general principles and trends that we are seeing, but actual case examples to drive home the point, because you, your employees, your families, your coworkers, you may have seen this, or to get you prepared for what you might want to consider doing if you're in this scenario. Joining me, of course, today are two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, Aaron Finkelstein, who's a senior member who's actually been managing attorney for almost 20 years and is now a mentor to many of the lawyers, and Maggie Wagner, who's actually been working in immigration law for several years, is a paralegal, is an attorney, and just very knowledgeable and does a lot of the CBP cases with our team. So with that, I would like for us to start off the discussion with maybe Aaron first, maybe giving just a brief, quick overview on what we are seeing with CBP at DOE, Aaron.
Yeah, well, thank you, Sheila, and thanks for those kind words. You know, there isn't a change in the law. I want to start off by saying that, but there has been a noticeable increase in the amount of scrutiny that CBP, Customs and Border Protection officers, have been given people at ports of entry, particularly for individuals entering the U.S. in employment-based non-immigrant categories such as H's, L's, O's, etc. The CBP officers are frequently, I'm not going to say usually, but I will say frequently, they're conducting very aggressive questioning. And they're looking at the content of the traveler's phones or electronic devices, which includes emails, WhatsApp, Signal, and social media type of posts. And the trend seems to be on a rise in which they're finding issues that result in something called expedited removal, which is their ability to refuse admission and send somebody immediately out of the country, which I believe Maggie is going to talk about that a little bit later on, which is often based on information that was obtained from searches of these phones or from statements that are made during these inspections. In some cases, the CBP officers are even providing inaccurate legal immigration information regarding visa validity or petition requirements, which can unfortunately still result in serious immigration consequences. They may be wrong, but you have to deal with the reality of their mistake. That's just the way that it ends up being. These types of mistakes that they're making, it can result in immediate denials to entry, cancellation of visas, and even 5-year bans from re-entry, in which there are waivers that can be obtained in many cases, but nonetheless, a huge inconvenience.
Aaron, this certainly sounds extremely troubling, very scary, that if they make a mistake, there's very little recourse the employer, the individual employee, and the family members have. But is this something that we could maybe go to CBP, CBP headquarters, a particular port director, the airport? You know, are there remedies that people have in these situations before we start having Maggie talk a little bit more about, you know, what actually happens after there's an expedited removal order?
So the short answer is that technically there is no appeal for the decisions that they're making. However, in many cases, you can go back to the port and open a dialogue. And if you can clearly document that there was error that they made, if you can clearly document that their findings was incongruent with the facts on the ground, you may be able to get things overturned or get some of these types of findings resolved. But it's an uphill battle. And it's better to follow the rule of an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. So I would say, yes, there are some things you can do when you're faced in that situation after the fact, but it's better to be well prepared.
Thank you very much for that clarification. And yes, agreed 100%. So Maggie, I know it looks like you're dying to share something about what expedited removal orders can result in.
And we also will talk more at length about, you know, the process that you can go through if you are wanting to contest this with Customs and Border Protection. But thank you for that introduction, Aaron. Expedited removal orders, you know, as Aaron was saying, they do remain the most serious consequence, or one of the most serious consequences, I should say, that can arise from an inspection at the port of entry. And that's because it results in an immediate denial of entry, an automatic cancellation of the visa, and a 5-year ban from reentry to the United States. And if you wish to reenter prior to that 5 years expiring, you would have to apply for a waiver. And that waiver process is pretty complex, and it's oftentimes pretty lengthy as well. And the individual has to apply for the waiver at the U.S. consulate while they're actually applying for a U.S. visa. So you have to, you know, obtain the basis to apply for a U.S. visa first, and then you have to go to that interview, and then you apply for the waiver, where the consular officer has to first recommend the waiver to the State Department. And this is where the lengthy process comes in, because the State Department has to then concur with that recommendation. And that can take, you know, up to 8 months right now. Some people, it can even take up to a year. And finally, you know, if the Department of State does concur with that recommendation, you're going to have the ultimate decision, and the consular officer will issue the waiver.
Got it. Okay. Again, as you said, lengthy process messes up people's jobs, lives, families, livelihoods, homes, cars, assets, kids' education, all of those stressful things that we see all the time, unfortunately. So to share some very concrete examples that we have been seeing, common fact patterns that frequently end up resulting in an expedited removal order, especially with what we've seen with H-1B workers, sometimes L-1 workers, O-1s, other kinds of categories, but H-1s, of course, are very common. And one of the common scenarios is where the person, H-1B worker, has obtained a CAT subject H-1B petition approval and the visa stamp from the consulate, let's say through employer A. The person then enters the United States and presents the petition approval and the visa to the CBP at the airport to show, hey, I want to start my employment with employer A. CBP then, after carefully reviewing, as you just heard what Aaron and Maggie just said, looking at the person's phone messages or WhatsApp or whatever, right, because they can open your phone, your iPad, your laptop, computers, anything, they discover that there are some emails where this individual may have written to HR representatives or applying for other jobs with recruiters at other companies, or to their friends, expressing an intent not to work with a particular H-1B sponsoring employer, CAP filed employer, but actually to use that employer merely as a stepping stone to look for a different job. Based on this, CBP concludes that the individual has almost committed some type of fraud or misrepresentation by saying I'm entering to work with employer A when their true intention may be to work with a different employer, and then ends up issuing an expedited removal order based on fraud or misrepresentation. And as you know, as many of you may know, once you get a 212A6C or one of the fraud findings, et cetera, for improper documents, it's not just 5-year bar, which in and of itself is horrendous, but it could be pretty much a lifetime bar because now you have fraud and misrepresentation against you, right? Another common example that we see, of course, is where the CBP officer ends up making a mistake, and I think Aaron just talked and alluded to it a little bit, is where the H-1B worker arrives at the airport, port of entry, with a valid H-1 visa stamp, but a new petition because they changed their jobs or employers. The CBP officer, maybe a rookie officer, maybe a lack of training, maybe some error, mistakenly informs the H-1B worker, hey, you need to be obtaining a new H-1 visa stamp in your passport each time you change an employer or a job, which, as we all know, is incorrect under existing policies and procedures with CBP and based on USCIS policy memos. And despite the person having all of the proper paperwork, the officer ends up incorrectly issuing the expedited removal order on the ground that the visa is not the correct visa, is not valid to work for the new employer. Terrible. Again, terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy that occurs. Aaron, what about questions about H-1BC that we see again, another very common example?
Right, so a lot of these situations, Sheila, have to do with the fact that there's a push for very strong enforcement, almost like a motivation for enforcement, and therefore people are, or I would say CBP is less open at the time, or perhaps the foreign national coming in is not comprehending at the time, that there are certain things that don't fit into what they're saying in the law. So I do think knowledge is power, and I do think being pre-prepared, if at all possible, is helpful. We see something where, for an example, H-1B fees are required to be paid by the employer. So when H-1B workers are coming into the port of entry, they're asking the employee who paid the fees for your H-1B, for your petition. Or sometimes they'll look on the phone or on a device, and they'll see where the employer will prompt the employee to pay something like the premium processing fees, which is permissible to be paid by the employee. But CBP is not making a distinction between fees that are arguably permissible and fees that are not permissible. Rather, they say, you see, the employee fee shared. And since the employee fee shared, and since the fees are required by law to be paid by the employer, it must be it's either illegal or it was fraud. And therefore, we're going to issue an expedited removal order. Again, just misinterpretation of the law. And we see that, again, what's a common one that we're beginning to see come up more and more is one that has to do with an employer-employee pay structure, specifically dealing with B2B, corp-to-corp, or consultants. And what you'll see from that is just a lack of understanding of the way consultancy works, where, for example, when somebody says, what's your billable hour for a consulting company is gross revenue. That's how much money is the individual bringing into the company as gross revenue. And then you'll say, well, how much do you get paid? Well, what a person gets paid, their salary or their hourly pay is usually consistently less than their gross that they bring into the firm, because the gross has to cover the electricity. It has to cover the expenses. It has to cover the profit. So therefore, when they express what their hourly rate is or what their salary is, CBP looks and says, aha, so you're giving a kickback to the employer, the difference between your salary and what your billable hour is. Sometimes the billable hour, let's say, could be $100, but the salary could be $80 an hour, and they're saying, oh, you're giving a 20% kickback. And if the individual is unable to explain the difference between gross revenue and salary, CBP very easily can get lost in that, and they'll turn around and issue an expedited removal order alleging financial fraud or fee abuse. So these are common types of things that do come up.
Thank you, Aaron. And you're so right. I think there is a huge lack of education and understanding on this issue. And with consulting companies, it's a common arrangement. And they're convinced that this whole thing is shrouded in some kind of fraud or misunderstanding. And you're right. It's, you know, people say, oh, your employer is keeping an extra profit. They're stealing your money. And the answer, like you correctly said, is no. The employer is paying for the rent, the electricity, health insurance, social security payments, you know, all of the gazillion expenses and charges. So Maggie, you know, okay, now the poor kid, the family, the person, the individual, the principal gets this ERO or expedited removal order. What should they, what can be done? What are they required to do to try to salvage the situation?
So the first thing that people should do and they should be aware of is that they are required to be given copies of documents from CBP. And one of those documents that they're supposed to be provided with is a sworn statement. And something that I see when I deal with these cases is that people aren't always provided this documentation. So, you know, if you're going through something like this, it's important to remember that you should be issued these documents. And if you're not issued these documents, ask for those documents to be issued. Sometimes they're put into people's luggage, and when they get home, they open their luggage and they see that the documentation is placed in there. So it's important to look through your luggage and see if there was any documentation issued and placed in there. And then, you know, it's important to, if you are, you know, presented these documents at the outset, it's important to review these documents for errors and inaccuracies. Hopefully you would be able to address those before you actually sign, because they will have you sign, whether it be on an electronic pad or, you know, with a pen and paper, they will have you sign something. So it's important to review the documents, especially the sworn statement, for inaccuracies, because sometimes it can be possible to correct that with Customs and Border Protection before you actually sign. I'm not saying all of the time it's going to be possible, but, you know, at least you can be aware of that fact. And, you know, once you have these documents, you can contact legal representatives who have had success, like the Mercy Law Firm, in negotiating a reclassification of the expedited removal order into a withdrawal of application for admission. And that involves communicating with the port of entry, writing to them and asking for that expedited removal to be reclassified to that withdrawal of application for admission. And what that does is that avoids the five-year bar for you. So yes, you weren't allowed to enter the United States, your visa is still canceled, but at least it avoids the five-year bar. However, you know, if the expedited removal is not reclassified, then you do have to apply for a waiver to re-enter to get around that five-year bar, because unfortunately there's no judicial review available or any sort of appeal that is available for someone who has issued an expedited removal order.
Got it. Okay. Thank you, Maggie. So let's further explain, because this whole thing, the concept of requesting the withdrawal of the application for admission to enter the U.S. is really a big deal, right? It's one of those things you can ask as the individual entering, or if it's your employee, as the employer, to train your employees that if they find that they are being pushed into a corner, to certainly request that instead of getting the removal, expedited removal with a most likely a five-year minimum bar, you could actually request to withdraw the application for admission. And generally, this might be approved by the Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, if the officer believes that the individual is inadmissible but does not have sufficient grounds to support the removal, the expedited removal, for example, if they believe that there is no clear-cut evidence of fraud or misrepresentation, they may decide, okay, I'll give you a bonus, I'll give you a benefit of the doubt, I'll let you withdraw your request to enter the U.S. And then the individual also must voluntarily agree to withdraw this request to enter the U.S., and the officer then approves that withdrawal request. And even though this makes, you know, feel like at least I, you know, dodged a bullet here, it is less severe than the expedited removal order because it does not carry a formal five-year bar. The visa is still canceled by law. The person is again required to obtain a new visa before attempting to re-enter the U.S. And sometimes the employers may not keep the job offer open forever, so you could end up losing your job, looking for a new petitioner, a new employer, a new case, coming back in. And the consulates, we often see, have sometimes a problem where they say, oh, you were sent back. There must be something more to this case. And they tend to sometimes delay issuance of the visa for the candidates in their cases. And another case situation that we've been seeing very recently in the last several months, not years, fortunately, is an Abu Dhabi pre-clearance, which was initially at one point considered a fantastic option because you didn't have to deal with U.S. immigration when you reach U.S. and within a few hours of your flight, for example, within a few hours of your flying from, let's say, somewhere in Asia, India, wherever, to Abu Dhabi, you could return back. But what we have seen is a troubling pattern where the CBP officers incorrectly insist that if the H-1B worker has been working remotely outside the U.S. for more than 60 days, that such a person is required to obtain a new LCA or labor condition application with the foreign location listed. The fact is the United States controls law within the United States of America. There is no long-arm jurisdiction to the rest of the world. And if a citizen of India, for example, is working in India for 2 months or 2 years, that does not require the U.S. employer to file the LCA because the Department of Labor cannot certify a work location which is outside of the United States. So clearly the Department of Labor will not agree, but if the individual doesn't know that or agrees and then takes this withdrawal or takes this expedited removal order, CBP will then use that to deny admission, require them to withdraw the application for admission. And again, as we said earlier, while this is not a bar to reenter, again, by applying for a new visa, it certainly creates complications, delays, loss of fees, hassles for the family, and additional expenses and stress and potential job loss, because it still results in the visa cancellation and all of the potential concerns when you have to reapply for the visa itself. So from that, let's pivot a little bit here, if we can, Aaron, to talk a little bit about various I-94 issues that you're seeing with CBP.
Thank you very much, Hua. And that was actually a very good explanation of what's going on with the LCAs and I think a cautionary tale. When you're dealing with I-94s that the CBP is issuing at the port of entry, they're really focused on three key things. They're focused on the U.S. visa, which has a PED that's written on the visa. The PED stands for petition expiration date. They're focused on the validity period of the passport. When does the passport expire? And they're focused also on the 797A or 797C, if there's a new approval with a new validity period with a new petition expiration date. These three things are moving parts, I would like to say. And I would say that CBP has been continuously inconsistent in the manner in which they issue the I-94. And many times when they're issuing the I-94, which is the document, obviously, that they issue when you enter into the U.S. that indicates that you're in status for a particular period of time, of course, when they issue that I-94, it doesn't necessarily reflect the appropriate duration of stay for the employment-based non-immigrants. Particularly, we see problems in context of new H-1B approvals. And while it's not entirely the case, we have observed a trend more and more with CBP officers and deferred inspection offices where they're failing to issue I-94s that match the validity period of a newly approved 797 notice if the individual enters the U.S. more than 10 days before the new petition start date. And in many of these cases, they'll issue the I-94 to reflect the end date of the old 797 rather than the new approval period. And the officers tell travelers the new 797 automatically takes effect when the I-94 expires. Now, there is a basis for this, but the problem is USCIS's interpretation of the last action rule may not be consistent with CBP's interpretation of who's considered to be in status and not in status. And unfortunately, this type of interpretation or this type of conflicting interpretations can create significant risk when you're looking at later extension filings or change of status requests directly to USCIS.
Thanks, Aaron. So what should the individual be doing in a case like this, Maggie?
Right. So, you know, given everything that was just said, it's going to be essential to review the I-94 immediately after entering the United States and confirm that the expiration date matches your most recent I-797 approval. And if that date, you know, doesn't match the most recent I-797 approval, it's worth it to visit a deferred inspection office to request a correction. Now, given the new trend that we're seeing, the deferred inspection site may say, no, you know, we are not within 10 days of that new I-797. Therefore, we're only going to give you the validity of your entry I-94 through your previous I-797. And then after that I-94 expires, your new I-797 will pick up and you'll still be in status. In that situation, it's probably advisable to obtain their position in writing, or at least try to. And what that means is you can go home and you can, you know, email the deferred inspection site and say, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on this. Once my entry I-94 expires, this I-797 approval notice will pick up and I will not fall out of status. Hopefully they respond saying, yes, your interpretation is correct and you have something in writing, so that if, you know, you're in the position where you are going to extend with USCIS, they don't necessarily agree with that interpretation, you have proof that you tried to go get that corrected and you have Customs and Border Protection's position in writing.
Okay. So it kind of makes sense, though also I can understand why they have some concerns, because by law they can never issue an I-94 that is valid for more than 3 years at a time. So if you got the extension 6 months before by paying premium, I think it is a potential problem. So either they don't travel or they travel and accept it, and like you said, at the end of the day, it's just supposed to pick up from where it is, and if USCIS says no, I would be hard-pressed, because hopefully over the next 2 years, the individual again travels, comes back, gets a fresh I-94 from CBP, because that is CBP's position. So this is different than some of the other cases where I think they have made clear errors. Here, I think they actually may have a valid basis and a reasoning, and USCIS should not be giving us a hard time or giving the individual or the employer a hard time. But saying all of this, I really hope that each of you who are listening and participating today and making time, effort, and energy to participate and understand some of these really issues, understand that at the end of the day, travel obviously has its share of risks, right? Always you have to be prepared to review your devices, because CBP by law is committed to review those each time you're seeking admission or entry into the United States. You have to understand your employment structure. What do I mean by that? Well, as an H-1B employee, you should be able to clearly explain what the employer-employee relationship is. You should know your own job duties, as mentioned on your H-1 petition. You need to know your work location, and hopefully that's going to match exactly with the LPA and work location mentioned on the H-1 petition. How the end client's involved with the process. Your compensation structure. My salary is, whatever, $80,000, $110,000 for the year, annual salary. And if you or your employee is issued the expedited removal, or offered the opportunity to withdraw admission to the U.S., whatever happens to you, you obviously hopefully will take the withdrawal request, but in either case, it is important for you to speak with Immigration Counsel. A lot of companies, immigration lawyers, tend to say they're not familiar with some of these issues, haven't been doing this. Certainly, I know at Moosey Law Firm, we've been doing it for decades now, and we have been successful in a lot of cases. So I hope that today's discussion with Aaron Finkelstein, Maggie Wagner, myself, Sheila Moosey, has been very helpful for you to understand what you can and cannot do and how you need to be able to articulate and present your own case with the CBP at the airport. On behalf of myself, Sheila Moosey, Aaron Finkelstein, Maggie Wagner, and the entire Moosey Law Firm team, we want to thank you for joining us for today's podcast and discussion. And we look forward to continuing to educate, empower, and enlighten you with all of the changes that are happening, because our goal is to fight for justice, to help our clients, to take care of you, and to do it in the best possible manner with the least possible fees. I look forward to continuing to take good care of you. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and thank you for making time today.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Moorthy Law Firm. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.moorthy.com.